A special 2-hour episode of Dark Shadows. So turn off the lights, close the curtains, and sit with your back against a safe wall. Because ready or not, here comes Dark Shadows.
Feel it. He's somewhere here.
Let's get it over with. It's almost sunset. Maybe we better come back in the morning.
No! It's taken us too long to find the Collinsworth crypt. Too many people have died while we searched. Well, now our search is over, and so is the Collins' reign of terror.
Wait, look, over here. The lamp. Yes, it's an inscription on the tombstone. Can you translate it?
It's in an ancient tongue. But I can make it out all right. It's a curse.
What does it say?
It says, look behind you!
What? Where?
That's what it says. It says, look behind you and relish your life till now. Because from henceforth, you will wish you were dead. Behold, the statement that struck terror into your ancestors' hearts. The solemn words, Mystery Playhouse is sponsored by...
Member of its work.
My dear.
There is nothing wrong with your radio. Do not attempt to change the station. We are controlling the transmission. We control the volume.
We can change the tone to a fuzzy bass.
Or focus it to a tinny treble.
We can speed things up so fast you can hardly understand what's being said.
Or we can make things so slow you don't care.
We control the content. We can make it boring.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive. It's our show. We can do anything we want. Because this is...
Mystery Playhouse. 90.1.
Vambarilla.
Wasn't that just scary?
Oh, you said it, Count. That was terribly frightening. And with Halloween so close, oh, I'm just extra frightened.
Oh, yes, we have a very scary Halloween show for all the kids out there, isn't it?
Very scary.
Oh, we've got the Hulk, we've got Robert Lowell, Stevenson's The Body Snatchers.
Ah, the Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Inquisition with Mel Brooks.
And Star Trek, do we have that too?
And The Meaning of Life, Suspense, Escape, and much, much more. So don't go away, because especially now we have my most superheroes. That's scary, scary Batman.
And Robin.
The true story, Vampirella. How it all began. Where did he come from? Where did he go? And what made him fight crime the way he does? Anyway, here it is at the count 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Batman and Robin, the dynamic duo, the Caped Crusaders fighting for righteousness and battling the evil forces of crime. Batman and Robin, in reality, Bruce Wayne and his young ward, Dick Grayson, live at the Wayne townhouse in Gotham City, where only their butler, Alfred, knows the secret of their true identities. From their hidden Batcave, with their fully equipped scientific laboratory deep beneath the Wayne house, using the powerful Batmobile and Batplane, with their own amazing physical skills and knowledge of criminology, Batman and Robin are able to strike out against the forces of evil wherever they may be in the world. But where did they begin? How and why did Bruce Wayne become the Batman and Dick Grayson Robin? This is the true story, the legend of Batman and Robin. Bruce Wayne was the only child born to Gotham City's millionaire Thomas Wayne and his wife Martha. As the only heir to wealth and power, young Bruce was raised by his parents in the finest traditions of life. They were proud of his excellent scholastic record and his achievements as an athlete. One fateful summer evening, when young Bruce and his parents were walking home to their townhouse on their way back from a nearby dinner party.
Gosh, it's certainly a nice night, isn't it?
Yes, but it's awfully dark here. Thomas, isn't the street unusually dark?
Yes, the street lights seem to be out. Sorry we didn't take the car now.
Can't move any of you, and you won't get hurt.
Oh. Watch out, he's got a gun.
What is this?
It's a stick-up, buddy. And I'll start with that nice jewelry you're wearing, lady.
No, my necklace.
Yeah.
Oh.
Take your hands off my wife.
Mister, I told you to be quiet or else. Give me that purse too, lady.
Oh.
How dare you give me that gun?
No, Thomas.
I warned you. You asked for it.
Dad!
Thomas, you've killed him. Help! Police!
I'm going to have to shut you up too, lady.
Mother! No! You murderer!
You punk, you're next. The gun's jammed. I gotta get out of here. Fast!
Mother! Dad! Oh, no! They're dead.
The gangster's bullets killed his parents and made an orphan out of young Bruce. The terror and shock of that terrible moment and the thought of revenge against the criminal haunted the lonely boy until finally he made a decision and wrote an historic entry in his diary.
And I swear by the spirits of my parents to avenge their deaths by spending the rest of my life fighting criminals. I will make war on crime.
As the years passed and the boy grew into manhood, he used his family inheritance for this one dedicated purpose. Working in almost total isolation, training his mind and his body as no man had ever done, he became a master scientist, building his own vast laboratory beneath the house.
He read and studied all the literature of criminology and police science, and he trained his body to physical perfection until he was able to perform amazing athletic feats and master the arts of self-defense. Throughout the years of study, Bruce's only companion was the family butler, Alfred, who had helped to look after young Bruce after his parents' death.
Mr. Wayne, sir, it's terribly late. Hadn't you better retire soon?
Alfred, it's 10 years tonight since my parents were... Since I...
Yes, sir, I know. And you've hardly left the house at all these past few weeks.
All these years, my research, my studies... It's time I put them to work, Alfred. I think I'm ready now to fulfill that vow. I have my equipment, my weapons, and my father's fortune to use. Now it's time for action. I've kept my plans secret from the world for a reason. I must have a disguise.
A disguise, huh?
Yes. Criminals are a superstitious, cowardly lot. So my disguise will be able to strike terror into their hearts. I must be a creature of the night. Black. Mysterious. What's that?
Something outside in the garden. Look there, flying against the moon. It's a bat, sir.
A bat? That's it, Alfred. It's an omen. The perfect disguise. I shall become a bat.
And thus was born the Caped Crusader, the figure of the dark, this avenger of evil, the Batman. As the Batman, Bruce Wayne was able to design his own special terrifying symbols. His mask and cape, his utility belt with special tools and weapons, the Batmobile, and the powerful Batplane, all with secret hiding places, enabling him to strike out at will against the forces of evil. Soon the Batman became a legend in Gotham City and elsewhere. As the strange, secret figure of the Batman swiftly brought criminal after criminal to justice, the police were quick to use his help and rely on the Batman in time of need.
Hello, Commissioner Gordon speaking. Is this the governor? Ah, good. Now, you'll be glad to know I received an answer from Batman today. No, we still don't know who he really is. We'll continue to investigate, though. But frankly, I almost don't care who he is, as long as he keeps up the good work. Yes, Governor. He's agreed to let us install a special private telephone line here on my desk, along with the searchlight signal on the roof. That way we can send out a call for Batman instantly, whenever we need him. No, he insists upon having the telephone installed privately so we can't trace the other end. Yes, I think it's an excellent idea. We'll call it the Bat Phone. Yeah, yeah.
The exploits of the Batman soon filled the newspapers. Television and radio spread word of his conquests to all parts of the land. In the underworld, gang leaders met in secret hideaways to discuss new ways and means of protecting themselves against this deadly adversary. And in even more sinister ways, crime continued to spread its evil roots. In Gotham City, a shred of broken rope was about to weave its way into Batman's life and his future. Bruce Wayne had established the Wayne Foundation, an organization for research and sponsorship of worthwhile projects in the public interest.
Good afternoon. This is the Wayne Foundation.
Hello, Miss Marshall. This is Bruce Wayne.
Yes, Mr. Wayne.
Is today the day that the Foundation is taking that group of orphans to the circus?
Oh, yes, and I'm glad you called. The director of the orphanage just called. He's ill, and we'll have to get someone else to drive his group of children over there. I'm bringing two other groups, and I can't.
Well, why don't I bring them myself? It's pretty late in the day to call anyone else, and... Well, I haven't been to a circus in a long time.
Well, of course, Mr. Wayne. That's a wonderful idea, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Let me give you the address of the orphanage. yourself, Mr. Wayne?
Yes, Miss Marshall. I forgot how exciting the circus is. And these children are really having fun. Look at them.
Yes, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, for the next trick, the Flying Graysons will perform an unbelievable feat on the high trapeze. Father, mother, and son, all three will attempt a simultaneous double somersault without the use of the net.
Without a net? Isn't that very dangerous?
Yes, it is. But they're very good, those Graysons. And that boy of theirs is fantastic. For his age, he's one of the best young acrobats I've ever seen.
There they go. Oh, look.
A one. A two.
The trapeze. The rope is broken.
They're falling.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain in your seats.
Terrible. All three of them.
Miss Marshall, stay here with the children.
Where are you going?
I want to see the owner of this circus. Those ropes are tested before every performance. They can't just break like that.
Moving swiftly, Bruce Wayne disappears into the crowd. Moments later, he reappears at the office of the circus manager, but now in his guise as Batman.
Where is the owner of this circus, Mr. Brady?
Here. I'm Brady. What do you want?
Batman?
Yes. I want to show you something, Brady. Look at this rope from the trapeze. You see this here? These strands were cut, not broken. The Grayson's fall was deliberately planned. They were too experienced to have an accident like this.
Yes, I know. I know. Look, come into my private office here. I must talk to you.
All right, Brady. What do you know about this?
Batman, I wasn't going to tell anyone about this, but the Graysons, they're my star performers.
They were, Brady. Never again.
Oh, no, they...
The mother and father are dead. The boy is injured, but he'll be all right. Now start talking. Who would want to murder the Graysons?
Racketeers, those gangsters.
What?
I didn't dare tell anyone. They threatened me. They wanted me to pay them protection money because I refused. They must have decided to kill my star act.
Why didn't you go to the police right away?
I was afraid of what they'd do to me, but I never thought they'd do anything like this. It's awful, that poor kid, Dick Grayson. He has no other family to see his parents killed like
that. All right, Brady, pull yourself together. Now give me the whole story. Who are they? What did those men look like? Could I see him now, Doctor?
Yes, Batman, but not for long. I've given him a sedative so he can rest.
Right. Dick? Dick Grayson, I want to talk to you.
Batman?
I thought you'd want to know, Dick. We have a good lead to the criminals who killed your parents. I hope to have them behind bars very soon.
What good will it do? It won't bring my parents back.
Dick, if it helps any... I know how you feel. When I was your age, my parents were killed by criminals, too.
I have no one now. I'm alone, an orphan.
So was I, Dick. I'm an orphan, too.
You too?
Yes. The death of my parents, just like yours, made me decide to dedicate my whole life to fighting crime.
If only I could do something like that, it would help avenge their death. Look, Batman, if I'm like you, I've got the same reason for wanting to fight crime. Let me join you, please. I could help. You'd have somebody to share your fight.
It would be nice to have a companion. With your acrobatic ability, plus what I could teach you, maybe you could make the grade.
I know I can do it, Batman. Give me a chance.
Well, I really hadn't thought of it before, but I could adopt you legally as my ward. You'd be the only other person who knows my secret identity. Besides Alfred.
Alfred? Who's that?
You'll meet him, Dick. Very soon, I think. But right now, you'd better try to get some rest. If you're going to become the Batman's companion, you'll be starting a training schedule with me that'll keep you working day and night.
Good. Good. Look forward to working.
Dick? Doctor? He's asleep, I think, now.
Good. And he's going to be all right, I think.
He's going to be more than all right, Doctor. I'll see to that.
That's it, Dick. Now, using judo, you're unarmed, and I come up behind you like this with a gun in your back.
And I do this.
Right. I'm powerless now. Now look at the screen. This is a highly magnified picture of hairs found in a hat at the scene of a crime. What do they tell you about the criminal?
Well, he was balding because the hairs have roots on them, proving they were not cut or pulled out, but fell out.
Right. Okay, cut in the supercharger. Watch the tachometer. That's it. You can handle the Batmobile as well as I can.
Now, in breaking down a random code, you first look for the frequency of repeated letters of the alphabet. The most common...
Let's go over the utility belt once more.
Okay. In here, explosive pellets. In here, smoke screen cartridges. In here, the flares.
Excuse me, gentlemen, but dinner is waiting, and... My Master Dick, what are you wearing?
His new identity, Alfred. I think Dick is finally ready to join the Batman. But Dick Grayson has become Robin, the Boy Wonder.
So the dynamic duo was born. The Batman and Robin, fighting side by side in a common cause. Now operating together as a team, Batman and Robin bring their first case to a successful conclusion in the office of Police Commissioner Gordon.
And there you are, Commissioner. A complete confession of the murder of the Graysons.
And enough evidence to get the rest of the gang that was working the protection racket set up for a nice long vacation.
The two of you seem to have done a very thorough job. It isn't enough having one of you a mystery, not knowing who you really are, Batman. But now there's two of you. Why, it's downright embarrassing. I don't mind telling you I've had three of my best men tailing you for the past 2 weeks, trying to find out just who you really are. And it's hopeless. They've done no good at all.
Oh, gosh, don't say that, Commissioner. They've done me a lot of good.
What?
Oh, sure. Batman's been able to show me all the different ways of losing people that are following you. It's been a big help to me.
Will you? Get out of here, both of you, before I lose my temper.
Batman.
Oh, Vampirella, that's just so scary. Batman, I tell you, I don't know about that music.
Oh, but something about that Batman, I don't know, Count. He just excites a woman, you
yes,
know.
Yes, he even drives me batty.
Oh, but it was terribly exciting to hear the true story of the Batman and Robin, wasn't it?
I always wondered, where did he come from and whence does he go?
And now we know, don't we?
You know, Vampirella, yes? Criminals are a cowardly, superstitious lot. That is why Batman chose the bat.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it was an omen.
Few things as frightening as the shadow of a bat with outspread wings behind you.
There's only one thing I don't understand, Vampirella.
What's that, Count?
If it was an omen to Batman, then that would mean that to Batman he was also superstitious. Was he cowardly like the criminals also, or have we forgotten that part?
No, I don't think so, Count, not at all. Well, he was above the criminal mind, you know.
I suppose there's only one way that we can really find out.
Yes?
That's next week. We must go for more adventures of Batman.
Oh, definitely. I can't wait to be with Batman again.
But that's then. This is now. Oh. And for now, we've got something even more scary for those evil people at Disneyland.
Disneyland? Oh, the shutters.
It's called The Very Long Fuse. And after that, we've got a ghost horror story from Nelson Olmsted. So don't go away. It's just too scary to say. 5-4-3-2-1.
Of course, you know what a fuse is. It's a long piece of cord impregnated with gunpowder. When you strike a match and light it, it burns fitfully, sputteringly to its end, at which there is a little surprise. Almost gone out. I will blow it into life. Poof. You thought there was going to be a huge explosion, didn't you?
I knew Gerard Fetz as well as anyone could know him when he lived at Debenham. He was a drunken old Scotchman. As I say, I knew him as well as anyone could know him. And I'm probably the only man alive who can tell you the following foul and unnatural events in his life that made him the useless drunkard he is today. In his young days, Fetz studied medicine in the schools of Edinburgh. It wasn't long before a Mr. Kramer, teacher of anatomy, singled him out and gave him a job. He had, among other minor duties, the delicate position of having to supply, receive, and divide the various subjects. In view of this, he lodged in the same building with the dissecting rooms. Here, he would be called out of bed in the black hours before the winter dawn by the unclean and desperate interlopers who supplied the table. The supply of dead bodies was a continual trouble to him, as well as to his master. In that large and busy class, the raw material of the anatomists kept perpetually running out. One morning, early, Fetz was called to the door, where two Irishmen stripped the sacking from their sad merchandise and demanded their money. He stared at the body and then said, "Well,
this is Jane Galbraith."
The man answered nothing, but shuffled nearer the door.
I know her, I tell you. She was alive and hearty yesterday. It's impossible she could be dead. It's impossible you could have come by this body fairly.
Oh, sure, sir. You're mistaken entirely, said one of the men.
The other looked Fetz darkly in the eyes and demanded the money on the spot. It was impossible to misconceive the threat or to exaggerate the danger. The lad's heart failed him. He stammered some excuses, counted out the sum, and saw his visitors depart. With horror, he waited for his immediate superior, the class assistant. This was Wolf McFarlane, a high favorite among the reckless students, clever, dissipated, and unscrupulous to the last degree. On this particular morning, McFarlane arrived somewhat earlier than usual. Fetz told him his story and showed him the cause of his alarm. McFarlane examined the body of Jane Galbraith and said,
"Well, yes, it does look fishy."
"Well, What should I do? Do? Do you want to do anything? Least said, soonest mended, I should say. Someone else might recognize her. She's as well known as the Castle Rock. Well, we'll hope not. And if anybody does recognize her, well, you didn't, don't you see? And there's an end. The fact is, this has been going on too long. You'll stir up mud and you'll get Kramer into the most unholy trouble. You'll be in a shocking box yourself, and so will I, if you come to that. For me, you know, there's one thing certain. There's practically speaking all our subjects have been murdered. MacFarlane. Oh, come now. As if you didn't suspect it yourself. Suspecting is one thing, and proof is another. Yes, I know. And I'm as sorry as you are this body should have to come here. The next best thing for me to do is not to recognize it, and I don't. You may, if you please. I don't dictate. But I think a man of the world would do as I do, and I may add, I fancy that is what Kramer looks for at our hands. Question is, why did he choose us for his assistance? And I answer, because he didn't want old wives. Well, this was the tone of all others to affect the mind of a lad like Fetz. He agreed to imitate MacFarlane. The body of the unfortunate girl was duly dissected, and no one appeared to recognize her. At 4 in the next morning, Fetz was awakened by the well-known signal. Descending to the door, he was filled with astonishment to find MacFarlane with his gig, and in the gig one of those long and ghastly packages with which he was so well acquainted. When they got the body upstairs and laid it on the table, Fetz looked at the face and was staggered. He looked from MacFarlane to the body and then back again. The face was that of a Howard Gray, a particular enemy of MacFarlane. Unprepared for a challenge so momentous, he knew not how to look his comrade in the face. It was MacFarlane himself who made the first advance. He said, You must pay me. Your accounts, you see, must tally. Pay you? Pay you for that? Why, yes, of course you must. By all means and on every possible account you must. I dare not give it to you for nothing. You dare not take it for nothing. It would compromise us both. This is another case like Jane Galbraith's. The more things are wrong, the more we must act as if they were all right. Now, come, give me the money. Fetz did so, but as if he were in a daze. Finally, the transaction complete, he found voice again. MacFarlane, I have put my neck in a halter to oblige you. To oblige me? Oh, come now. You did as near as I can see the matter what you downright had to do in self-defense. Suppose I got into trouble, where would you be? This second little matter flows clearly from the first. Mr. Gray is a continuation of Miss Galbraith. You can't begin and then stop. If you begin, you must keep on beginning. That's the truth. No rest for the wicked, you know. You're staggered at first. But look at Kramer, my dear fellow. You're clever. You have pluck. I like you, and Kramer likes you. You were born to lead the hunt. And I tell you on my honor and my experience in life, 3 days from now, you laugh at all these scarecrows like a high school boy at a farce. Before the week was out, MacFarlane's prophecy had been fulfilled. Fetz began to plume himself upon his courage, and had so arranged the story in his mind that he could look back at these events with an unhealthy pride. At length, an occasion arose when Mr. Kramer was again short of subjects. Pupils were eager, and it was part of this teacher's pretensions always to be well supplied. At the same time, there came news of a burial of a farmer's wife in the country graveyard of Glencourse. Mr. Kramer assigned Fetz and MacFarlane to snatch the woman's body from the grave. Late one stormy afternoon, the pair set forth well wrapped in cloaks and furnished with a jug of liquor. It rained without remission, a cold, dense, lashing rain. Bottle and all, it was a rather sad and silent drive. It was night by the time they arrived at the cemetery, and it was still raining. But Fetz was considerably improved in spirit by the help of the bottle. And as they turned in the front gate, he boasted, "Ha! The great thing, MacFarlane, is not to be afraid. Now, between you and me, I don't want to brag, but hell, devil, right, wrong, sin, crime, and all the old gallery of curiosities, they may frighten boys. But men of the world like you and me despise them. Here's to the memory of Howard Gray." The work was hard. But before long, they reached the coffin, at which time MacFarlane broke the little gig lamp that they had propped up for light by throwing out a rock. They were so nearly done that they judged it wisest to complete their work in the dark. The coffin was exhumed and broken open, the body inserted in a dripping sack,
and carried between them to the gate. They had both been wetted to the skin during their operations, and now, as the gig jumped along the deep ruts, the thing that stood propped between them fell now upon one and now upon the other. A creeping chill began to possess the soul of Fetz. He peered at the bundle, and it seemed somehow larger than at first. It grew and grew upon his mind that some unnatural miracle had been accomplished, that some nameless change had befallen the dead body. Finally, making a great effort to arrive at speech, he said, "For God's sakes, let's have a light." McFarland was agreeable, and they lit with difficulty the remaining gig lamp, which shed a wide circle of misty brightness around the gig. It became possible for the two young men to see each other and the thing they had along with them. The rain had molded the round sacking to the outlines of the body underneath. The head was distinct from the trunk, the shoulders plainly modeled. Something at once spectral and human riveted their eyes upon the ghastly comrade of their drive. McFarland said, "This isn't a woman."
"It was a woman when we put her in."
"Hold that lamp. I must see her face." And as Fetz took the lamp, his companion untied the fastenings of the sack and drew the cover from his head.
With a wild yell, each leaped from his own side into the roadway. The lamp fell, broke, and the horse bounded and went off toward Edinburgh at a gallop, bearing along with it the sole occupant of the gig. The body of the dead and long dissected Howard Gray.
Oh, that one just really chilled me to the bone.
Oh, I'll tell you that Robert Louis Stevenson was some kind of a scary writer.
I'm not even sure I'm going to be able to go trick-or-treating this year. That one just...
I know, Count. I don't know if I want to, actually, this year, after all of this scariness we're playing today.
Yes, yes. You know, I think we need to play something a little more, to bring up the spirits, if you get my drift.
A kind of a courage to fight this horror with. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. And then maybe we'll look death in the face. But first, something to relish up those feelings of bravery.
Be brave.
What could be more? More courage inspiring than Mr. Rogers?
Nothing, Count. Nothing at all.
Well then, enough talk. Let's put them on.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Here's a brave, strong song. You might like to march while I sing it for you. Or you might just like to sit and listen. Be brave, and then be strong. Be brave, you'll not be wrong. If you are right, keep your chin up tight. And be brave, and then be strong. Be brave, and then be strong. Be brave, you'll not go wrong. With your own might, you will reach the sight. So be brave and be strong. Wrong. With your own might, you will reach the sight. So be brave and be strong.
The Meaning of Life, Part 7. Death.
Yes? Is it about the hedge? Look, I'm awfully sorry.
I am the Grim Reaper.
Who?
The Grim Reaper.
Yes, I see.
I am Death.
Yes, well, the thing is, we've got some people from America for dinner tonight.
Who is it, darling?
It's a Mr. Death or something. He's come about the reaping. I don't think we need any at the moment.
Hello. But do leave him hanging around outside, darling. Ask him in.
Darling, I don't think it's quite the moment.
Do come in. Come along in. Come and have a drink. Do. Come on.
It's one of the little men from the village. Do come in, please. This is Howard Katzenberg from Philadelphia, and his wife, Debbie.
Hello there.
And these are the Portland Smythes, Jeremy and Fiona.
Good evening.
This is Mr. Death. Well, do get Mr. Death a drink, darling.
Yes.
Mr. Death is a reaper.
The Grim Reaper.
Hardly surprising in this weather.
Yes. So you're still a reaper out here, do you, Mr. Death?
I am the Grim Reaper.
That's about all he says. There's your drink, Mr. Death.
Do sit down.
We were just talking about some of the awful problems facing the third...
Would you prefer white? I'm afraid we don't have any beer.
The Stilton's awfully good.
I am not of this world.
Good Lord.
I am Death.
Well, isn't that extraordinary? We were just talking about Death only 5 minutes ago.
Yes, we were, you know. Whether Death is really the end,
as my husband Howard here feels, or whether there is, and one so hates to use words like soul or spirit, but...
What other words can one use?
Exactly.
You do not understand.
Ah, no. Obviously not.
Well, let me just tell you something, Mr. Death.
You don't.
Just one moment. I'd like to express on behalf of everybody here what a really unique experience this is.
Here, here. Yes, we're so delighted that you dropped in, Mr. Death.
Can I just finish, please?
Mr. Death, is there an afterlife?
Dear, if you could just wait, please, a moment.
Are you sure you wouldn't like some sherry?
Angela, I'd like you to say this at this time. If I could, please, really.
Be quiet.
Can I just say this at this time, please?
Silence. I have come for you.
You mean to...
Take you away. That is my purpose. I am Death.
Well, that's cast rather a gloom over the evening, hasn't it? Don't see it that way, Jeff. Let me tell you what I think we're dealing with here. A potentially positive learning experience that can...
Shut up! Shut up, you American. You always talk, you Americans. You talk and you talk and you say, let me tell you something, and I just want to say this. Well, you're dead now, so shut up.
Dead?
Dead.
All of us?
All of you.
Now, look here. You barge in here quite uninvited, break glasses, and then announce quite casually that we're all dead. Well, I would remind you that you're a guest in this house.
Quiet. Englishman, you're all so fucking pompous. None of you have got any balls.
Can I ask you a question?
What?
How can we all have died at the same time?
The salmon moose.
Darling, you didn't use canned salmon, did you?
I'm most dreadfully embarrassed.
No. The time has come. Follow.
I didn't eat the moose.
So Death took them down the last road. The final journey from which there is no return, when the meaning of life itself would finally be revealed.
Behold!
Where am I? In the village. What do you want? Information. Whose side are you on? That would be telling. We want information. 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 You won't get it. By hook or by crook, we will. Who are you? The new number two. Who is number one?
KZSU, Stanford. Ego Hulk, the other side of the coin, the raging soul of an otherwise peaceful man, the incredible Hulk, huge, powerful, unthinking, destructive, wanted for murder. David Bruce Banner, gentle physician and healer, now a fugitive from himself, living in the shadow of the monster within. forever fearful of its next outburst of violence, desperate in his search for an answer, a cure.
There's got to be a way. I can't go on like this, a prisoner of my own emotions.
For it is anger which triggers the altered molecular mechanism within his body that turns the gentle physician into a rampaging monster.
I can't go on forever wondering if there's a killer within me, never knowing where or when he might emerge, forever hiding my true identity.
David Bruce Banner, calling himself David Benson, man on the run, on the road to everywhere, searching, always searching.
Okay, Benson, this is as far as I go.
Thanks a lot. Johnville, huh?
Coal mining town. Ain't much to look at, but you might find a job here.
Well, thanks again. Mr. Jason?
That's me.
Somebody said you had a job opening.
Yeah, the payroll department. Could use someone.
Well, my name's Benson. David Benson.
This is my daughter, Betty.
Hi.
How do you do?
And this is Keith Moore, our general manager. You'd be working for him if you qualify.
Mr. Moore?
You had any experience in accounting, Benson?
No, not exactly, but I've got a college degree.
What field?
Chemistry.
That doesn't mean you can figure payroll.
Keith, darling, if Mr. Benson knows chemistry, I'm sure he's good with figures.
The job's temporary.
Well, that's okay with me.
All right. What do you say, Keith?
It's your coal mine.
You're on, Benson. Keith will show you around and what to do.
Keith?
Yeah, Benson?
Well, I was looking through this ledger and...
Give me that book.
I was just going to point out that...
These aren't the accounts you're supposed to be working on.
Well, there seems to be some discrepancy.
I said, these books aren't part of your job. Do I make myself clear?
Okay.
Sorry, but I'm uptight today. Just get back on these payroll forms, will you?
Sure.
Lunch, Keith?
Not now, Betty. I think I'll work through.
How about you, David?
Yeah, sure. That sounds good, Miss Jason.
The name's Betty. Come on. I'll show you the great little drab town of Johnville.
Car was on fire. I deserved to escape, but my wife was trapped. I couldn't get her out. Died.
I'm sorry, David.
Ever since that day, I thought if only I had that superhuman strength, that surge of untapped energy that comes in time of crisis. If I'd had that, I might have saved her.
Don't torture yourself, David. Nobody has that kind of brute strength. To be able to turn over a flaming automobile with his bare hands.
Some do.
Name one.
The Hulk.
Who?
I don't know. What did I say?
Hulk, bulk, something like that.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know why I said that. I can't remember.
David, are you all right?
Huh? Sure, hon. I'm fine. Don't mind me. Sometimes I get absent-minded, like the proverbial professor. Let's order, shall we?
For David Bruce Banner, the Hulk is a shadow, a dark, forbidding shape existing deep in his mind. He is aware but cannot remember. He suspects but cannot prove. He lives in constant fear of this unknown being within him. The Hulk. The horrible result of David Banner's experiments with gamma rays when he tried to find superhuman strength. Now that he possesses it, it has become a nightmare.
What about you, Betty?
Very simple, very fast. I'm the daughter of a coal miner. A nice guy, my father, but not very successful. So I help him with the mine. And here I am, stranded in drab little Johnville.
How's the mine doing?
Not very well.
Losing money?
No matter how much coal we mine, the profits never seem to go up. Dad's even thinking of closing down. Why, David?
Well, nothing. Just wondered, that's all.
What do you want, Benson?
Look, I haven't said anything to Betty or to Mr. Jason.
What are you talking about?
The other ledger. The double set of books.
Are you out of your mind?
Moore, I'm not an accountant, but even a kid could figure that you're bilking the mine, stealing the Jasons blind.
You are bonkers.
Am I? Betty's a nice girl, thinking about marrying you. The old man looks on you like a son.
So?
Maybe you have time to save yourself, Keith.
How would I go about that?
Restitution. Put the money back. They never know.
I was doing it for their own good, you know.
Come on, Keith.
I'm not kidding, Benson. The least you can do is hear me out.
All right, I'm listening.
Jason's an old man. He's lost his touch, doesn't care anymore. Bet he never knew much about mining anyway. Wasn't interested. There's an old section of the mine, tunneled by Jason's grandfather before the turn of the century. It's full of high-grade anthracite. I've been putting the money there, improving it. I know it'll pay off.
Why haven't you told them?
They were against it from the start. They think it's mined out, but I know it isn't.
Will all this expense show up in the books?
Sure. Better than that, let me show you the mine.
But...
Wait till you see that coal. Pure anthracite. Come on. It's only a little way. About a mile out. Over here, Benson.
I thought you said you were improving this place.
That's what I said.
The support timbers, they're rotting.
Not up ahead.
You've been repairing from the inside out?
That's where the anthracite is.
Wouldn't it be safer to reconstruct from the mine entrance?
The overhead beams aren't that bad. They'll hold. Come on. You have to see this. Black gold.
More. More. More, where are you?
Over here.
The lights went out.
I know.
You got a flashlight?
Of course.
I can't see it. More, where?
Over here. Just follow me.
I can't see you, more.
Over here, Banner. See? Over here.
Moore, cut the kidding.
Just follow me. Pied Piper, right?
Moore, where are you? Turn on your light. Moore.
I know this mine like the back of my own hand, Benson. I don't need a light. Just follow my footsteps.
Moore.
You're right, Benson. These overheads are pretty weak. I think if I kick one, like this... Why, I think the whole place might cave in. Where are you, Benson? Where are you now?
Behind these rocks. What have you done? You trapped me. More!
You didn't really think there was any coal left in this old shaft, did you? The Jasons are stupid people, Benson. Trusting people. Pretty soon they'll learn their lesson. When they're broke and I own the mine.
You're gonna leave me here?
You got it. Nobody will ever know. This mine hasn't had a foot set in it in over 50 years. Enjoy yourself, Benson. Find some coal while you're waiting. If you can find any.
David Bruce Banner, trapped in a remote coal mine, sealed in a natural tomb, the air becoming close, stifling, the underground waters rising. But within the peaceful man, the rampaging monster breaks his bonds. Ice-cold anger turns to raging fury. And from the blazing fury there emerges... The Hulk! Huge, massive, a towering juggernaut, the Hulk strikes out at everything around him. Walls crumble, timbers snap, crack. Great boulders are thrown like small pebbles as the Hulk rampages through the mine. Charging through the tunnels like a roaring tank, the Hulk overtakes Keith Moore.
No! No! Get away! What are you? No! No! No!
Passing Moore, the Hulk makes for the mine entrance, destroying everything in his path. Timbers fall behind him. Great rocks crash to the ground. Ceilings cave in.
I'm trapped! Save me! Don't leave me! Come back!
Reaching the mine entrance, the Hulk staggers into the sunlight, breathing air in great gulps. And then skulks away into the hills.
They find him yet?
Yeah, way down the shaft, out of his head, raving about some monster.
I'm sorry, Mr. Jason. He was like a son to you, wasn't he?
Sort of, yeah. I knew him a long time.
Can't figure out what he was doing down in that old shaft. We had it closed as unsafe.
He say anything to you about going in there, David?
He did mention something about reopening it. The anthracite there, he said. After that, I don't remember.
Well, he was wrong about that. That was mined out years ago. They say it was the Hulk that caused the collapse.
The Hulk?
Some kind of monster. People dream up the weirdest things. You're welcome to stay on, Benson. I'll be needing a new manager, and you seem to know your onions.
That's nice of you, Mr. Jason, but I think I'll be moving on.
Where to, David?
I don't know. Anywhere, everywhere. I can't seem to stay in one place very long.
Well, suit yourself. Excuse me. Hey, Charlie, see you a minute?
What are you looking for, David?
Huh?
What are you after? What are you searching for?
I don't know, David. Myself, maybe, or peace. I don't know.
We look at the base of a brain, which has just been removed from the skull. There's very little of the midbrain that we can actually see. Yet, as I demonstrated in my lecture last week, if the under aspects of the temporal lobes are gently pulled apart, the upper portion of the stem of the brain can be seen. Are there any questions before we proceed?
I have one question, Dr. Frankenstein.
That's Frankenstein.
I beg your pardon?
My name. It's pronounced Frankenstein.
But aren't you the grandson of the famous Dr. Victor Frankenstein, who went into graveyards, dug up freshly buried corpses, and transformed dead components into...
Yes, yes, yes. We all know what he did. But I'd rather be remembered for my own small contributions to science, and not because of my accidental relationship to a famous... cuckoo. Are there any last questions before we leave?
Dr. Frankenstein.
Yes?
Isn't it true that Darwin preserved a piece of vermicelli in a glass case until by some extraordinary means it actually began to move with a voluntary motion?
Are you speaking of the worm or the spaghetti?
Why, the worm, sir.
Yes, it seems to me I did read something of that incident when I was a student, but you have to remember that a worm, with very few exceptions, is not a human being.
But wasn't that the whole basis of your grandfather's work, sir? The reanimation of dead tissue?
My grandfather was a very sick man.
But as a Frankenstein, aren't you the least bit curious about it? Doesn't the bringing back to life what was once dead hold any intrigue for you?
You are talking about the nonsensical ravings of a lunatic mind. Dead is dead.
But look at what has been done with hearts and kidneys.
Hearts and kidneys are tinker toys. I'm talking about the central nervous system.
But, sir...
I am a scientist, not a philosopher. You have more chance of reanimating this scalpel than you have of mending a broken nervous system.
But what about your grandfather's work, sir?
My grandfather's work was doo-doo. Class is dismissed.
Dr. Frankenstein.
That's Frankenstein.
My name is Gerhard Falkstein. I have traveled 5,000 miles to bring you the will of your great-grandfather, Baron Beaufort von Frankenstein.
What would Mary Shelley think of this?
She'd be scared! What else?
Frankenstein, don't forget that name.
How could I? He's a good friend of ours, remember?
Oh, yes, but so particular about pronunciation, you know?
Oh, that's right. He's under anonymous name, that's right. Okay, well, going back, would you heard, of course, excerpts from the Mel Brooks classics and Frankenstein, with the Hulk thrown in there for added scariness. But right now, we have the honor of presenting to you...
Oh, yes.
...his great ghoulishness. Alfred Hitchcock. Present.
Alfred Hitchcock present with another terrific tale from radio's classic era. This week, a special treat. Trick-or-treat, that is, for all the Halloween fanatics out there. Here we have one of the all-time most famous episodes from Escape. Three at Skeleton Key. This particular episode stars one of my most favorite yet loathsome beasts, the rat. But first, we must pause a moment for a word from another rodent, our sponsor.
Escape is brought to you by Primetime Radio of San Jose. Join KZSU every Thursday night at 10:30 for more classic radio theater with Escape.
Few are aware, but in fact the rat was the original star in my motion picture Birds. It was my executive director, however, who pointed out how angry the public would be if it went to a picture entitled Birds and received rats instead. So at the last moment I gave in. We filed the 3 million rats and rewrote the scripts. This did not go over very well with the rats, however, who, in a demonstration against capitalism and the motion picture industry, sailed to Russia to defect. As you will soon discover, they didn't make it. But they did break into radio. Here, then, is their exciting story, Three at Skeleton Key.
Tired of the everyday routine? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all?
We offer you Escape! Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Escape to a lonely lighthouse off the steaming jungle coast of French Guiana and a nightmare world of terror and violence, as George Toulouse describes it in his hair-raising tale, Three Skeleton Key.
Picture this place, a gray tapering cylinder, welded by iron rods and concrete to the key itself, a bare black rock, 150 feet long, maybe 40 wide. That's at low tide. At high tide, just the light, rising 110 feet straight up out of the ocean. And all about it, the churning water, gray-green, scummed apple, warm as soup, and swarming with gigantic bat-like devilfish, great violet schools of Portuguese man-o-war, and, yes, sharks. The big ones, the 15-footers. And as if this wasn't enough, there was a hot, dank, rotten-smelling wind that came at us day and night off the jungle swamps of the mainland. A wind that smelled like death. Set in the base of the light was a watertight bronze door. And in you went, and up. Yes, up and up, and round and round. Past the tanks of oil and the coils of rope, cases of wicks, racks of lanterns, sacks of spuds, and cartons and cans. And up and up and up, round and round. Over the light storeroom was the food storeroom. And over the food storeroom was the bunk room where the three of us slept. And over the bunk room was the living and cooking room. And over the living and cooking room was the light. She was a beauty, balanced like a ballerina on the glistening steel axle of her rotary mechanism. At night, you'd lie there on the stone deck of the gallery with the light revolving smoothly and quietly over your head, easing her bright white eye 360 degrees around the horizon. You'd lie there watching to see that the feeders kept working, that everything ran right. It wouldn't be bad. The other two fellows snoring in their sacks two levels down. You'd smoke your pipe to kill the stink of the wind, and it wouldn't be bad. About those other two, Louis and Auguste, what a pair. Louis, he was head man, was a big fellow from the Basque country. Black beard, little hard black eyes, and a pair of arms that, I tell you, those arms were as big around as my legs. Yes, head man he was, and what word he let go was law. Silent fellow, and although I spent my first 2 weeks trying to strike up a real conversation, the most I could ever get out of him was...
I took up this profession because I don't like people. They talk too much. It's quiet work, light tending. Let's keep it that way. You're getting to be as bad as August. I thought maybe for once they'd send me somebody...
That was Louis. And when he accused me of becoming like August, I quieted down, because August was the talkingest man I've ever met. The talkingest and the ugliest. He was hunchbacked, stood 4 feet high, had red hair and big blue eyes. It seems he'd been an actor in Paris.
In over 200 different productions, dear boy, at the Grand Guignol. Oh, but it was monstrous horrible, the way we used to scare the audience. I was hated. Yes, yes, they used to throw things and hiss and bare their teeth at me. Finally, it got too bad. I couldn't stand it any longer. I gave up the theater. My nerves, you understand, yes, gave it up completely. I really did. I couldn't.
It all started one morning at 2:30. I was on watch, lying on the cool stone deck, pulling on my pipe, staring out at the blackness, the phosphorescent combers and the big yellow stars, when, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed something show up for a second, something the light had touched, far off. I waited for her to come around again, and when she did, there it was. A three-master, a big one, about a half mile off, and coming down out of the north-northwest, coming straight for us. You must understand, our light was where it was for a very good reason. Dangerous submerged reefs surrounded us, and ships kept clear. But this one, this sailing vessel, was coming straight on. I went over to the gallery door and yelled down.
Louis! Louis!
I had the glasses out now. I couldn't read her name, but I could see her quite plainly. All sails set, the foam creaming away under her bow, her beautiful lines. A Dutch ship, I guessed her. Why didn't she turn? Every time it passed, our light hit her with the glare of day.
Ship? Where?
North-northwest. The light will touch her in a moment.
Well, can't she see us?
Look at her. She just keeps coming on.
The square heads.
What is it? What is it?
Watch. North-northwest.
Ah. I know. I know what it is.
What?
It's the Dutchman. The Flying Dutchman. We did a play about her. Oh, what a performance. You ghastly galleon. Hag-ridden, curse-driven. Must-on.
Oh, shut up, will you? Yeah, she's luffing.
Yes.
It's a sloppy way to come about. She's derelict, that's it.
Derelict?
Abandoned. Crew left her for some reason or another. But instead of sinking, she's gone on, running before every wind.
She'll not run long. Not with these reefs to break her up.
A beautiful ship. Now, why would men leave a beautiful ship like that?
She didn't ram us, although we all expected it. But as we waited for the crash, she luffed again. Caught some odd gust and went about. We watched her the rest of those black hours, heeling and rocking, pushed and pulled by every stray wind, every freak current. Watched her until the dawn came, till the sea turned from black to pearly gray. And on she came again, heading for us. We all had our glasses trained on her now.
August, you can kill the light.
Right, Chief.
She doesn't look so good by daylight. Think she'll ground this time? I say, do you think she'll ground this time?
This is impossible. Absolutely impossible.
What?
Here, take my glasses. They're better than yours.
All right. What is it, your... I had to focus. And then... my breath froze in my throat. The decks were swarming with a dark brown carpet that looked like a gigantic fungus, but undulating. And on the masts and yards, the guys and all, were hundreds, no thousands, no millions. I don't know. An inestimable number of tremendous rats.
See them?
Yes. I see them.
Now we know why she's derelict.
Yes, now we know.
What are you two doing? Here, give me a look.
Yes, give him the glasses. Take a good look, chatterbox. Give you something to talk about.
She's still heading for us.
Yes.
If she's going to turn, she'd better turn soon.
Suppose she doesn't.
You mean suppose she piles up on the quay?
It's low tide.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Well, where's all the conversation, August? Huh? Here, you want the glasses again? You want another look?
No, no.
She's still coming on.
Go away! Go away!
Turn, will you? Turn, I say! I pray you turn. Cracked up.
The rats! Look, on the water! Like a carpet.
They're swimming.
Sure, they're swimming. Those are ship rats.
But they're swimming for the rocks.
The door below. It's open.
Well, come on.
And down we went, racing down the stone stairs, taking them three and four at a time. Scared? You bet we were scared.
August, you get the windows. Maybe they can climb. We don't know.
Right, Chief. But hurry. Hurry.
Look. You see them?
No. Oh, yes, I do. Up at the other end of the rock.
Look at them.
Millions.
They smell us. Here they come. Oh, close the door.
I can't. It's stuck.
Here, let me.
Move, you.
Made it.
Holy, that was close.
One got in. Look, there.
Well, get him.
Watch it. Kick him.
What a brute.
He was as big as a tomcat, bigger. And his eyes were wild and red, his teeth long and sharp and yellow. He went for us, starving ravenous. And we fought him, fought that one rat all over the room. It was, oh, believe me, I don't exaggerate. It was like fighting a panther.
I got it.
We'd better get aloft. As we ran up the winding staircase, we passed the tiny windows of the various levels, and at every one was a thick, wriggling, screaming curtain of brown fur. I was ahead of Louis, and I dreaded each successive level. Suppose they had found a way in.
Look at them! Oh, will you look at them?
It's a nightmare.
Will you look at them?
The air of the gallery was thick and fetid with the stink of them. The light was dim, brown, filtered through the crawling mass that swarmed over the glass. All about us. We couldn't see the sky. Nothing. Nothing but them. Their red eyes, their claws, their wriggling hairy snouts, and their teeth. The rats. They screamed and howled and threw themselves against the glass. They were starving. And we three, we stood very quietly. Oh, very, very quietly. In the center of the glass room. Under our beautiful light. And we waited.
What can we do?
What can we do, Chief?
Take it easy. Take it easy.
I can't. I just can't.
Won't do any good to... It won't do any good to stand here and shake.
That's right.
Go away. Go away, do you hear me? Go away, the citizens.
They won't go away. Not until...
What is it, Chief? Not until... What?
Not until they've been fed.
You can take just so much horror, and then you get used to it. And they were interesting to watch, you know. They couldn't understand the glass. They could see us, and they could rush at us. But that thin, invisible barrier held them off, stopped them. From time to time, we caught a glimpse of the rocks below. More rats down there, swarming brown velvet in the bright tropical sunlight. And then the tide began to rise. If only it had drowned some of them.
Ships rats don't drown. No, sir. You can't drown one of them. They're all climbing up the tower.
This bunch around us is getting thicker.
Say, what's the time?
6:15.
You've got first watch, Sean.
All right.
Wake me at 10.
I will.
Come along, Ogle.
It was getting dark. One side of the room was lit a soft, filtered red. Sunset through the rats. Oh, very pretty. I set the wicks, checked my fuel, and then lit the lamp. It caught them, lit them in their gigantic wriggling web of pale, hairless bellies, twitching red tails, bright eyes. And then I started the rotary motor. The light drove them mad. As she swung slowly and smoothly about, she blinded them in the fierce, stabbing bar of light, moving continually about, ever turning, ever touching, ever moving around and around. And they, twitching and shuddering, eyes flaming when they were struck by the light, the bright light moving. And behind, on the dark side of the room, so close, I dared not turn my back, as you can't help turning your back when you're in a room made of glass. On the dark side of the room, you couldn't see them, but only their eyes. Thousands of points of blank red light, blinking and twinkling like the stars of hell. Louis relieved me at 10. But I didn't get much sleep that night. And when I came up into the gallery early the next morning, there stood Auguste, his back to me. He was bowing to the rats, waving his arms and making a speech.
Dear audience, I am going to play once again that magnificent role which made me the toast of the Paris theater. Prelati, the evil genius of the medieval underworld. I am he who did guide the dark soul of Marischal into the nether.
I stood staring at him, horror-struck. But he didn't notice me. The man had gone mad. He kept turning, telling his stories to all the rats, leaving no one out. August! August!
Another one, a late comer. Take a seat on the aisle, dear patron.
Stop it, stop it.
Zimbere, the blood-stained monster, was my partner in iniquity.
He went on, bowing and scraping to the rats, his big blue eyes rolling and winking, his wild red hair waving about him. I grabbed him by the arms and smacked his face. He looked at me like a child, and then his face screwed up. He looked as though he were about to cry. Go below. Go on.
Oh, very well, then. Later, my dear audience, later. Matinee today.
Sure, he was crazy. But I guess we all were. A few hours later, he came back up and caught Louis and me teasing the rats. Yes. Sounds horrible. It was fun. We would get right up against the glass and make faces at them. It drove them crazy. They would scratch away, trying to get at our eyes. Louis was even cuter about it. He'd pull a piece of bread out of his pocket and press it against the glass. The rats would scramble into a solid ball, biting each other, clustering like grapes. From time to time, a whole knot of them would slip and fall 110 feet to the surf below.
Look! Look at the sharks.
They're eating them.
Those sharks are our friends. Here, I'll get another bunch together. Here, my beauties. That's it. Pile up. Kill each other, huh? There they go.
Auguste joined in, too. Very ingenious, Auguste. He learned that if he spread-eagled himself against the glass, they'd bunch and bundle against his figure. Then he'd leap back.
Look! My portrait in rats!
It went on all day. And then I was lying in bed. It was about midnight. I was very tired and I was just beginning to fall off to sleep when I became conscious of a new sound. I couldn't figure it at first. I got up, lit the lamp, and went to the window. Even as I looked out, I saw one of the panes begin to sag in. They had eaten the wood away.
Louis, come quick!
What? What is it?
They found a way in!
I held the glass with my hand. Now they were all going crazy, and assured of the success of this maneuver, were all nibbling away at the wood. Louis ran below and then returned with a large sheet of tin. We spread it against the window and hammered it into place. Even as we did so, we felt the heavy bodies thudding against the other side as the window gave way.
There! That ought to hold. If it doesn't, we're done for.
Rats can't eat tin.
No, they can't. But what was that?
I don't know.
Came from below.
The storeroom window.
Yeah. They're in. They're swarming up the stairs.
Off the trap.
Hey!
There! What? Two of them got in.
Let's go after them.
We didn't have to go after them. They came at us. I leaped to one side and grabbed a marlin spike, swung, and smashed one in midair.
No!
I whirled to see Louis with the other. It had ripped his hand open and the blood was pouring out. He held his hand aloft and kicked at the snarling rat. I stepped and swung and got him.
Oh, my hand! He got my hand!
That's both of them, Louis. I'll get you something to tie that up.
Blood! Look at it, my blood, I bleed!
Don't worry about it, Louis.
Bleed.
Here! I'll wind this kerchief around it. It'll be okay.
Blood.
There! There, that's not bad. Just the flesh. And then I became conscious of a new sound. They were gnawing their way through the wooden trap door. I watched the wood, fascinated. And even as I did, it began to give way. And a bristling, whiskery nose showed through.
Louis! We've got to go up!
The next level was the living quarters and kitchen. I slammed the trap there, but it too was wood.
Oh, my blood. What are we going to do?
I don't know. They'll be through this one in a minute.
To the gallery. The trap door in the gallery is metal.
Good. Come on. We made it. We lay across the trap door, exhausted, while below us the rats took over the entire tower. I could hear them howling and fighting over our food supply, our water, our leather. And all about us, the others screamed and glared in at us, swayed in a tangled mass, hypnotized by the ever-turning light. By morning, the air in the little room was horrible. Until now, we'd been getting air from the tower below. Now that was sealed off.
And so was all our food and water. We lay exhausted, panting, waiting. And the hours crawled on. I was almost dozing from fatigue when I saw a sight that brought me too fast.
Would you like to come in, my beauties? Would you? I hold the powers of life and death, and I can let you in, you know.
August was standing by the glass, and in one hand he held a big wrench. He was tapping the glass gently, not quite hard enough to break it. I eased myself to my feet, and slowly, very slowly, tiptoed toward him.
All I have to do is tap just a little harder, and...
I found a coil of wire in the toolkit, and I trussed him up, fastened him to a stanchion in the center of the room. Louis was of no help. He lay on his side, looking at his bloody hand, weak and sick as a baby. So there I was, a lunatic and a coward for company. And all about, watching our little drama, the rats. The day dragged by. The supply boat wasn't due for another 12 days. I don't know what they could have done if they had come. And we had only one way of summoning them. That was to shoot off distress rockets. But the rockets were four floors below. And even if they'd been right there in the gallery, I couldn't have opened a window to fire them. That night, I tended the light, but its flame was devouring our oxygen. The following day, we lay thirst-tormented, starving, waiting. And the following night, I again tended the light. But the small supply of spare wicking we kept in the gallery had become exhausted. And quite suddenly, at about midnight, the light went out. There was nothing I could do. Wicks were stored three levels below. Nothing I could do, nothing. From time to time, I'd strike a match to see the clock. And when I did, it lit up the million red eyes about us. All about. Watching. Waiting. Below, it had grown quiet. They'd cleaned us out, and now they, too, were waiting. All waiting. And then, the rats, quite suddenly, were silent. And then I heard it. And then I saw the sky and the stars. The rats were gone. I went to the glass. Out there on the water, a small freighter, a banana boat, showing a few lights, came softly and innocently towards us. Our light was out. They didn't know. I wanted to open the windows, to call out to them, to warn them somehow. But I was afraid. What if the rats were hiding from me, tricking me? So I waited. She grounded very softly on a reef not 200 yards from the quay. Grounded so gently that the man playing the cornet, was he a passenger, crewman, off watch, didn't even stop playing. They tried washing her back off. I could have told them to save their fuel. The tide was rising, would have floated her free. And I waited. That's the story. The sun came up, and there wasn't a rat on the whole quay. Every last one of that terrible army had left us, gone back to sea on their new ship. August, insane asylum. He never recovered. And Louis? They took him into Cayenne, where he died of blood poisoning from his bite. Yes, that's the whole of it. And if you'll excuse me now, I must go set my traps. No, mouse traps. No rats in this lighthouse. I should say not. Life in the lights isn't bad. But sometimes, when I see a strange vessel approaching, I get a little nervous. Sure. Somewhere on the seas, there's a little banana boat without a crew. That is, without a human crew.
Escape is produced and directed by William N. Robeson. Tonight we have presented Three Skeleton Key by George Todus. Goodbye then until the same time next week, when once again we offer you Escape. Escape has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
You would hope with such a debut, our rat brethren would forget old animosities and let bygones be bygones. Alas, I continue to receive death threats and mysterious gifts of tainted cheese even to this day. So if any of you build a better rat trap, please beat a pathway to my door. And while you're at it, see if you can design something in the line of piranha repellent or electric eel protection. Oh, I forgot to tell you about them. But that's another story for another time. Perhaps next week. Till then, however, this is Alfred Hitchcock present saying farewell.
I am Frau Blücher.
Steady!
How do you do? I am Dr. Frankenstein. This is my assistant, Inga. May I present Frau Blücher? I wonder what's got into them.
Your rooms have been prepared, Herr Doctor. If you will follow me.
Igor, would you bring the bags as soon as you're finished, please?
Yes, Master.
After you, Frau Blücher.
Follow me, please.
Stay close to the candles. The staircase can be treacherous.
This is your room. It was your grandfather Victor's room.
I see. Well, seem to be quite a few books.
This was Victor's.
the Baron's medical library.
And where is my grandfather's private library?
I don't know what you mean, sir.
Well, these books are all very general. Any doctor might have them in his study.
This is the only library I know of, Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
Late in the evening, when the dancing was over, and the women were cleaning up the remains of the doughnuts and cider, the men gathered round the fireplace, lit their pipes, and began to tell the ghost stories of which they were all so fond. And just before they went home, they called on Ichabod, who told the story of the headless horseman of Sleepy Hollow, which was always the most frightening story of all. After saying good night to Katrina, Ichabod got on his old horse Gunpowder and plodded off towards home. It was midnight, the witching hour. Somewhere, far in the distance, a dog howled. The wind moaned across the high hills, and all the stories of ghosts and goblins that he had just heard began coming back into his mind. The night grew darker and darker, gloomier and gloomier. Ichabod had never felt so lonely in his life. He started to whistle to keep up his spirits. As he passed the great oak tree near the Sleepy Hollow Bridge, Ichabod began to feel better. Soon he'd be home. But suddenly, he heard a groan. His teeth chattered. But it was only some branches creaking together. As he approached the Sleepy Hollow Bridge, Ichabod's heart began to thump. Old Gunpowder started across the bridge. Slowly, very slowly, they were almost across the bridge when there, right in the middle of the road before them, a huge black shape loomed up out of the night. Ichabod turned the horse and clattered back across the bridge. The huge black shape rode after him. Ichabod's heart was pounding, and he rode faster and faster and faster. But the huge black shape kept gaining. Ichabod looked behind him, and he saw, silhouetted against the moon, a horse and a rider. The horse was black. The rider wore a long red cape, and there on the saddle in front of him, he carried his head. Ichabod kicked old Gunpowder to make him go still faster, but it was no use. The headless horseman was right behind him now, and then next to him, riding right alongside. Ichabod turned just as the horseman lifted his head from the saddle, held it high in the air, and threw it straight at Ichabod, knocking him off old Gunpowder and into a ditch. The next day, when the children went to school, Ichabod wasn't there. He wasn't at his house either. He was nowhere to be found. The only remains of Ichabod were his horse, old Gunpowder, cropping the grass in the warm fall sunshine next to a ditch not far from the Sleepy Hollow Bridge. And at the bottom of the ditch were Ichabod's hat and the shattered remains of a pumpkin head. But Ichabod himself was never seen in those parts again. Everyone agreed that Ichabod had been carried off by ghosts. Almost everyone, that is. Brom Bones, who married the pretty Katrina a few months after Ichabod disappeared, just laughed when anyone told the story. He just threw back his head, and he laughed and laughed and laughed.
I'm going in there. Bring me that candle.
No, yes!
Love is the only thing that can save this poor creature. And I am going to convince him that he is loved, even at the cost of my own life. No matter what you hear in there, no matter how cruelly I beg you, no matter how terribly I may scream, do not open this door or you will undo everything I've worked for. Do you understand? Do not open this door.
Yes, Doctor.
Nice working with you.
Get me out. Let me out of here. Get me the hell out of here. What's the matter with you people? I was joking. Don't you know a joke when you hear one? Open this goddamn door. I'll kick your rotten heads in. Mommy! Hello, handsome. You're a good-looking fellow, do you know that? People laugh at you. People hate you, but why do they hate you? Because they are jealous. You are a god. And listen to me. You are not evil. You are good. This is a nice boy. This is a good boy. This is a mother's angel. And I want the world to know, once and for all, and without any shame, that we love him. I'm going to teach you. I'm going to show you how to walk, how to speak, how to move, how to think. Together, you and I are going to make the greatest single contribution to science since the creation of fire.
Dr. Frankenstein, are you all right?
My name is Frankenstein!
Te burlaste de mí y yo en ti creía, mi hermano.